Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Jimmy Akin here with us for another hour, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And it's an Ask Me Anything this hour, but it's the Feast of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary, a holy day. And we've already got all the questions in because we're doing a little pre-record for this day. And all the questions are in from the internet. It's an internet Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. Jimmy Akin, of course, the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. And everywhere I go, Jimmy, people tell me, like, you know, talks or, oh, I think I told you about this on the cruise, too. How much they love Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, or now people have the merch. There was this couple there both wearing their Jimmy, and they were kind of like talking to me in a way like posing almost and trying to get me to notice that they were both wearing Jimmy Akin t-shirts. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Now there's two t-shirts we have right now for Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. One of them is it's got an illustration of my face and then all these different mysteries that we've covered on the show surrounding it. And another is of a UFO with me greeting an alien at the base of the UFO ramp. Which one were they wearing, or both?
I think it was the UFO. Well, I remember the UFO one, so I know at least one of them was wearing that. I can't tell you. I don't remember the other one.
Yeah. Just curious. I've been like wearing that same shirt with me in the UFO, like at Walmart, and I had a clerk say, "Is that you?" And I was like, "Yep, that's me."
Yeah. Is it a pretty good depiction of when you actually met the UFO, or is it just?
I can't talk about
it. Okay. All right. Fair. He never talks about it. All right. Back to the questions we go. Jenna wants to know this. How did the numbering of the chapters and verses in the Bible come about?
Okay, so I'm going to do a solid here for our marketing director, Donna Barrick, by mentioning that very information is in my book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. So here's a plug for the book. And I'm not going to leave you hanging. I'm going to tell you, but I thought I'd read what I wrote about this in The Bible is a Catholic Book. So this will give people in the audience a taste of the book, and they can order it and learn lots of other fascinating stuff. So here's what I said. An important development in biblical scholarship was the introduction of chapter divisions. Modern readers are so familiar with chapters and verses that they often don't realize that these weren't there from the beginning. The only biblical book that naturally has chapters is the Psalms, because each psalm is a separate hymn. That means that in a modern Bible, Psalms naturally has 150 chapters. However, the other biblical books originally didn't have such divisions. Over time, they began to be added. Jewish copies of the Old Testament were frequently divided into paragraphs. In both Jewish and Christian circles, the portions used in the liturgy were divided into sections so that they could be read aloud to the faithful at the appropriate times of the year. However, there was no standard universal way of dividing the text in Bibles. Individuals began to experiment with chapter divisions, and the system that stuck was created by Stephen Langton, who lived in the 1100s and 1200s, the Catholic Archbishop of Canterbury. So that's how we got the chapter divisions. How did we get the verse divisions? Well, the chapter divisions allowed people to more easily cite and look up a passage. No longer would commentators have to say things like, "Isaiah speaks of the suffering servant towards the end of his book." Now they could say, "Isaiah speaks of the suffering servant in chapter 53. Eventually, the verses also would be introduced. The modern system of verses came from the Protestant Frenchman Robert Estienne, who lived in the 1500s, when he published an edition containing them in 1551. So there were other chapter systems and other verse systems, but the ones that stuck were Stephen Langton's chapters and Robert Estienne's verses.
Oh, very good. You can get The Bible as a Catholic Book over at shop.catholic.com. Jenna, thank you very much for the question. Plenty of time for another question before we have to take a break. Oh, here's another question from Jenna. If you could meet any three Egyptian pharaohs for dinner, I like the start of this, Jenna. And they wouldn't try to kill each other, guaranteed. Who would you choose and why?
Well, I'd also want to make sure they tell me the truth. So maybe I can have a truth serum, which doesn't exist in real life, but maybe I could have a truth serum slipped into their food. Because what I'm interested is not just, I want to know stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I want them to tell me the truth. But come on, just three? There are a lot of pharaohs I'd like to meet. There's a lot of stuff I'd like to clear up. Having said that, if I had to pick just three, one of them would definitely be Ramesses II from the 19th dynasty, because he is the lead candidate by a long way for being the pharaoh of the Exodus. And I'd love to ask him questions about the Hebrews and the Exodus and his experience and so forth. He reigned for a phenomenally long time, and he had a lot of really interesting stuff happen in his reign that wasn't even connected with the Exodus. Like he fought the Hittites, and then as he got older, he said, let's make peace with them. And he and the Hittites negotiated a peace treaty, and we have the peace treaty. And it talks about like how when they implemented it, they had a big feast because we're not fighting each other anymore. And you have Egyptians and Hittites sitting down together, and they're eating. And the text notes they were eating together without fighting.
Nice.
So you know, I'd love to meet Ramesses II. Another that I'd love to meet is from the previous dynasty. That's Akhenaten. And Akhenaten is famous as the heretic pharaoh. I did an episode of Mysterious World all about him, so you can check that out. He tried to change Egypt's religion. And what he did, and he kind of did it in stages, but basically he tried to introduce monotheism. He prohibited the worship of the traditional Egyptian gods, and instead he introduced the worship of one god who he depicted as the solar disk, which was known as Aten. And so Akhenaten, his name, that's a new name he took on in honor of his favorite god. It means like the living Aten. And his son, Tutankhamun, his name means the living image of Amun. Tutankhamun's birth name was Tutankhaten, because his dad was an Aten worshiper, and so Tutankhaten's original name meant living image of Aten. But then, when Akhenaten died, everyone was like, let's go back to the old religion. And so they had, even though he was a little boy, the advisors of King Tutankhaten, like his vizier I, who was really running the show, A-Y-I, said, we need to go back to the old gods, and so you need to change your name. And he became Tutankhamun, Amun being the hidden god. And so his name came to mean living image of Amun. Well, then, in any event, I'd love to interview Akhenaten about his monotheism and the events of his reign. He was also this kind of hippie king who, like, he stopped fighting battles, and he's getting diplomatic communiques saying, please send the army. Things are really stressful here. And then you get a later message like, please send in the army. They are attacking and stuff like that. And he wasn't interested. He wanted to just hang out in the desert and love and celebrate. He had introduced a new art style and worship Aten and not be bothered with any of this statecraft business. So people hated him. And when he died, things quickly reverted with his son Tutankhamun on the throne. But he was a little kid. And I was running the show. And so then Tutankhamun mysteriously dies, and there is some evidence he may have been murdered. And then his vizier, I, becomes the next pharaoh.
What do you know?
And I, at the time, was an old man, and so he didn't last very long. And then the next pharaoh is a military guy named Horemheb. And Horemheb had been one of Tutankhamun's advisors. And then he worked for Ai, and then he became Pharaoh himself when Ai died. So the third of the three that I would like to introduce is the 18th century, 18th dynasty, Pharaoh Horemheb, because he'd have all the dirt about what happened with Tutankhamun and Ai and the princess who was married to Tutankhamun, who Ai, it looks like he killed another Hittite prince, and who was the son of a Hittite king named Shupuliuma. And I've got a whole story about this, again, on Mysterious World. But if I could talk to Horemheb, he could settle all of this stuff and give us the straight dope about what really happened and who murdered who and stuff. And he was the last pharaoh of the 18th dynasty. So the three, if I have to pick only three, would be Ramesses II, Akhenaten, and Horemheb. If I get to pick a few more, Narmer, the first king of the first dynasty who set the pattern for later pharaohs, would love to interview him. Khufu of the fourth dynasty, who built the largest of the pyramids. Ramesses II's successor, Ramesses III, because there was some palace politics with Ramesses III, where, believe it or not, he like any pharaoh, he had a harem of wives, and there was a black magic harem conspiracy to assassinate Ramesses III. Wow. And I did an episode about it. It's the Black Magic Harem Conspiracy. It's episode 89. But they used black magic as part of their efforts to assassinate Ramesses III. And he did die. And we've got the court records. So I'd love, but they don't tell us everything. So I'd love to interview Ramesses III from the Ptolemaic dynasty in the first century BC and the first few centuries BC. I'd love to introduce Pharaoh Ptolemy II Philadelphus, who founded the library at Alexandria, and under his tenure, the Septuagint was reportedly translated. So I'd like to interview him both about the Library of Alexandria and about the creation of the Septuagint and what really happened. And then the last pharaoh of the Ptolemaic dynasty, Cleopatra. She would be great to interview too and learn all about her dealings with Julius Caesar, who she had a baby with. So Caesar was her baby daddy. And then Mark Antony and Augustus, who I'm sure she was not fond of. So she would be a fascinating interview subject too.
Thanks so much for that question. That question was also from Jenna. Jimmy, your interest in the Egyptians definitely comes out in your enthusiasm for that answer. Mm-hmm. We'll take a very quick break. We'll be right back with more Internet Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
EWTN Radio posts 11 podcasts every weekday and over 60 per week. They're the perfect companion for busy Catholics everywhere. With on-demand access to audio, you can pause and pick up right where you left off anytime, anywhere. And they're all free. Subscribe by going to EWTNradio.net, then click on podcasts. They're waiting for you. EWTN is the global Catholic network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Having a good time with Jimmy Akin, and lots of questions from the internet for Jimmy. And the next one, kind of a long question from the internet, so I will get right to it. This one comes from Thomas. Father Spitzer believes that God first created a group of proto-human beings starting with two non-ensouled pre-hominids, one man and one woman. These were Y chromosomal Adam and mitochondrial Eve, and God created them 200,000 years ago. These two spawned many humans, and from those humans came several different subspecies of man. Wikipedia lists 19, though some of these are disputed, and if I recall, there may be more. Then around 70,000 years ago, God created our ensouled ancestors, Adam and Eve, and their descendants began migrating all over the world. All Homo sapiens today.
Homo sapiens.
Oh, I'm sorry. What did I say?
Homeo.
Oh, all right. All Homo sapiens today descend from these two, and all other non-ensouled Homo sapiens, or human subspecies, eventually died out. All right, assuming this theory is correct, would it be immoral or bestiality for ensouled man to mate with non-ensouled Homo sapiens or the other ensouled subspecies of man, such as Neanderthals, Denisovans, or Homo erectus? Would this be bestiality? Could the mating of non-ensouled human and an ensouled human be where we got the idea of the Nephilim from? The sons of God, ensouled, mated with the daughters of man, not ensouled, creating Nephilim? Do you know of any books on these various prehistoric human subspecies as well, including the taxonomy, prehistory, and anthropology?
Okay, so I haven't read what Father Spitzer has written on this subject, so I can't really comment on that. I'll just interact with what you describe, though I suspect that there may be something getting distorted in the transmission, because the theory that is described here is not the standard scientific understanding. Y chromosomal Adam is the last universal male common ancestor, genetically speaking. The Y chromosome is passed down exclusively from the male, through the male line. Women don't have Y chromosomes. And if you trace back all the Y chromosomes among human men, they do all go back to a last common universal ancestor from whom all living men are descended. Now, that didn't mean that all men are descended from him, but all living men are descended from this one guy. And he's called Y chromosomal Adam. It's also not a given that he was the only man at the time. It's just his Y chromosome line came to dominate. And it's estimated that Y chromosomal Adam lived between 160 and 300,000 years ago. Mitochondrial Eve is the last common ancestor of all human beings based on mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondrial DNA, the mitochondria are organelles within our cells. They're not part of the nucleus, but they do have DNA. And so this is called mitochondrial DNA. Mitochondrial DNA is passed down exclusively through the female line. We all have it, but we all got it from our mothers. So it doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman, you've got mitochondrial DNA that you got from your mom. And if you run an analysis on across the human population, all of the living humans have an ancestor that was one woman who is known as mitochondrial Eve. She lived between 100,000 and 203,000 years ago. She was not the only woman at the time, and not all women in history are descended from her, but her mitochondrial DNA came to dominate, and so all living humans have mitochondrial Eve as an ancestor. But it is not commonly believed in the scientific community that mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosomal Adam knew each other. They probably didn't live at the same time. They probably lived thousands of years apart, with Y chromosomal Adam living even 100,000 years before mitochondrial Eve. So the idea that they were a pair that preceded our biblical Adam and Eve is not the standard scientific understanding of this topic. And so I suspect that something may be missing in the transmission of this idea. Having said that, could there have been a pair of individuals 70,000 years ago that we are all descended from, even though they weren't the only individuals around? Well, the beginning of modern man is debated. It looks like Homo sapiens, you know, within the last 100,000 years is when Homo sapiens arose. And you can reckon, and there is a jump in behavioral complexity with Homo sapiens. It's referred to sometimes as behavioral modernity, where we start seeing our ancestors, based on archaeology, we start seeing them do more complex modern behaviors. You know, decorating things and stuff like that. And so 70,000 years for the start of behavioral modernity in our species is not unreasonable. But if there was such a pair that all modern humans are descended from, we don't see evidence of it in the genetic record. We do see evidence for universal common descent from Y chromosomal Adam and mitochondrial Eve, but they lived way before 70,000 years ago. And so we don't see a single couple in the right time frame that we're all descended from. Having said that, there's also another thing that we need to talk about here, which is that in the description of the theory that was given here, it referred to this couple 70,000 years ago as being ensouled, and all previous humans, including Y chromosomal Adam and mitochondrial Eve, as being non-ensouled. But standard Catholic theology holds that all living creatures have souls. Doesn't matter whether you're animal, vegetable, or human. You got a soul because it's what keeps you alive. And the different creatures have different types of souls. So those creatures that are very, very close to being fully modern humans would have souls that are very, very close to being fully modern human souls. So we wouldn't describe them as unensouled. We would say, okay, they're almost human, so they have almost human souls. A difficulty we face here is that we don't know how to map the biblical conception of man onto the genetic record. A lot of people tend to assume that in order to qualify as a human in the biblical sense, you've got to be Homo sapien. But Homo, as opposed to Homo neanderthalensis or Homo denisovan or whatever, Homo floresiensis or whatever. But that's a problem, because Homo sapiens is a modern biological category, and Adam or man is a biblical category. And you can't just assume that they're the same thing. In order to answer the question of what counts as man in the biblical sense, you'd need to be able to know what the biblical author of Genesis would consider a man. And here we've got a problem, because the author of Genesis didn't know about all the kinds of humans there are. He lived in you know, Israel and or thereabouts, and so he knew about Europeans, and he knew about Africans, and he knew about Middle Easterners, but he didn't know about Australian Aborigines. He didn't know about Native Americans. But if you just say, well, whatever he knew about, that's biblical man, then you're going to have to say, okay, Aborigines and Native Americans are not biblical man, and that's ridiculous. If you took an Aborigine or a Native American and introduced them to the author of Genesis, he would say, of course these are men. They're kinds of men I didn't know about, but of course they're men. Well, if he could do that, then he could do the same thing if you introduced him to a Neanderthal or a Denisovan. You know, he could say, of course, these Neanderthals, I mean, they bury their dead. They, you know, they have a system of worship. They've got language. Of course, they're men. And so it, so you have to be sensitive to the fact that we don't know how to classify near human, near Homo sapiens, like Denisovans and Neanderthals. They may count as biblical men. Having said that, if they do count as biblical men, then it wouldn't be immoral for our ancestors to breed with them. It would not be bestiality. And there's a little more to say about this, but we're coming up on the break, so I'll say the rest on the other side of the break.
Oh, all right. Oh, you got me. I was all drawn in. All right, we have to wait. That's what we call a tease. And hang on, we will find out as we continue. It was a long question, a lot of details, but about the origins of human beings. And we'll continue that with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live. What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
As we read the Gospels, every Christian faces the question again and again, what does Jesus mean? Getting the answer right is critical to both growth in holiness and fruitful evangelization. Want to know Jesus better so you can introduce him to your friends? Then it's time to get serious about understanding his words. Why not join Catholic Answers for our 10th annual Apologetics Conference? Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ, September 26th through 29th, right here in sunny San Diego. Learn from our guests, Dr. Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, Father Sebastian Walsh, Billy Junker, Father Paul Check, and, of course, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. It'll be 4 days of fun, faith, fellowship, and a live radio show. Seats are still available, but going fast, visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today. A little bit of groovy music there for you. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We had to take a break right in the midst of a fascinating topic, actually one that I know lots and lots of people are interested in, about the origins of humanity. I won't try to sum up where you were, Jimmy. Maybe you could do that.
Sure. Go. So I was, after discussing the current scientific consensus regarding, you know, the foundational questions that were asked, I was now proceeding to the three main questions. And the first one was, would it be bestiality for a modern human to mate with, let's say, a Neanderthal or a Denisovan? Well, if Neanderthals and Denisovans count as biblical man, then it would not be bestiality. They would just be a different kind of human, just like it's not bestiality for a person from Africa, let's say, to mate with a Native American. They're both biblical humans, and so it's not bestiality. It's just a mixed marriage. In the case of, on the other hand, if Neanderthals and Denisovans and so forth don't count as biblical man, well, it's still not like you're mating with a donkey. You know,
yeah.
It's and you got to ask, what level awareness did people back then have of species differences and stuff?
Right.
They might say, okay, this Neanderthal, they're not exactly like me, but, you know, they're enough like me. And so it's hard to label it bestiality in any sense, because if it were true bestiality, you couldn't get fertile offspring. You know, this a standard definition of what counts as a species in biology is if two organisms can breed successfully and have the offspring be fertile so that the line can continue, then those two individuals are of the same species. And since, you know, we know that our Homo sapien ancestors were so hot that Neanderthals and Denisovans wanted to mate with them and successfully mated with them and had fertile offspring, which is why we've got their DNA in ours. Biologically, they would count as the same species. They might be different subspecies, but they would be the same species. And so, again, the charge of bestiality doesn't look like it would apply. On the other hand, if it did apply, well, they did it anyway. But, you know, okay, they were fallen. So then there's the second question. Given the, you know, could this interbreeding be responsible for the Nephilim we read about in Genesis 6? Well, the interbreeding occurred tens of thousands of years ago, and there are some traditions, like the Big Dipper in the sky, or I should say the Great Bear, Ursa Major. There are some traditions that genuinely have lasted for over 10,000 years. Like we know the recognition of Ursa Major is at least 15,000 years old. I won't go into how we know that, but we do know that. And so you can have very long-lived traditions, but Ursa Major is in a different category because everybody was staring up at the sky every night. You saw Ursa Major every single night. And so you would, and they didn't have TV back then. So they watched the night sky and they'd tell their kids, oh, yeah, that's the Great Bear. And so you can see how this tradition was reinforced every day to let it be passed down over that kind of lengthy period. But you don't see near humans mating with humans or near Homo sapiens mating with Homo sapiens every day. And so you wouldn't expect that kind of tradition to be passed down for tens of thousands of years. So it is very unlikely that the author of Genesis, who is writing about 1000 BC, would have been aware of any of this crossbreeding with near humans. So I think it's very unlikely that this is the explanation for the Nephilim in Genesis 6. I think, furthermore, the idea that the sons of God are ensouled, or at least have fully modern souls, while the daughters of men are not ensouled, or at least don't have fully modern souls, does not fit with the text. The if anybody here is not a normal human, it's the sons of God. That phrase is used in the Old Testament to refer to high-ranking angelic beings, such as the ones we see at the beginning of the book of Job, where you've got God on his God comes into his throne room in heaven, and all the sons of God come in with him. They're high-ranking angelic beings. And so the idea that the sons of God in Genesis 6 would be true humans and the daughters of men, the daughters of Adam, are not true humans, it just doesn't go with the text. I think we know how the biblical author understood this, and the sons of God in this text, despite what a lot of people think, really were understood to be high-ranking angels. And I did an episode of Mysterious World on the Nephilim, so you can check that out to hear the evidence about that. In terms of the third question, do I know of any books relating to all this? There are a number of books. One that you might want to check out is about the Neanderthals specifically. It's called Kindred, and the subtitle is Neanderthal Life, Love, Death, and Art. It's by a woman named Rebecca Ragg, W-R-A-G-G, Sykes, F-Y-S-Y-K-E-S. So Kindred, Neanderthal Life, Love, Death, and Art by Rebecca Ragg-Sykes.
Thank you, Thomas, for that question. It's an internet Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. Philip wants to know this. In the early church, when a bishop was elevated to a diocese, it was understood that he was to hold the position for life. And bishops transferring dioceses was explicitly forbidden by the canons. But by the time we get to the early modern period, we see bishops routinely leave, being moved around, getting only, this getting more common in the 20th century. When exactly did this practice change and why?
Well, the practice of bishop shift in diocese goes all the way back to St. Peter, because originally he was the bishop of Jerusalem, but then he became the bishop of Rome. So we have precedent for bishops transferring dioceses in the Bible itself, even though they didn't yet have the term bishop didn't yet have its modern meaning. But in retrospect, it applies to Peter. The fact that certain councils rejected the practice, that's a sign some bishops were doing it. Otherwise, you don't prohibit things no one's doing. And so these councils thought it was a bad idea and rejected it, but that's only a sign that some people were still doing it. Well, eventually, as the Holy Spirit led the church and the church had a lot of experience with different situations, it was discerned that there can be good reasons for it. Now, it's also can be very good for a bishop to remain in his diocese for his entire life or until his retirement at least, but there can be good reasons for transferring a bishop. For example, you might want to test out a new bishop in a smaller diocese before you promote him and give him a big important one. Because if he's not the right guy, you don't want to give him more responsibility. So it was discerned that there can be good reasons for transferring a bishop from one diocese to another. And so the older regulations were eventually modified.
All right, Philip, thank you for that one. This one comes from Jenna. I have heard that some people believe Melchizedek and Shem, the son of Noah, are the same person. Please explain why some think so and share your opinion on the matter.
Okay, so the idea is based on the fact that if you use the length of lifespans that are reported in the Masoretic text edition of the Old Testament and you add them up, it would turn out that Noah's son Shem would have lived into the lifetime of Abraham. In fact, he would have even lived a little bit longer than Abraham, which is kind of surprising. And Abraham shows deference to Melchizedek. And so, well, if he was the son of Noah, that would explain that. But this idea is based on rabbinic Jewish sources that are over 1,000 years later. And that is a big mark against it. It is entirely speculative, and it is – now we're moving into the my opinion section. There's just no basis for it whatsoever in the Genesis text. In the Genesis text, if two people are the same guy, they should have the same name. Or – there should be a statement saying they're the same guy despite the name change. And there's nothing like that. So when you have Shem introduced in Genesis 6 to 9, and then much later, you have a completely different, you have a guy with a completely different name, Melchizedek, introduced, you should assume they're two different guys. Otherwise, you could assume Shem is really anybody in the biblical text. You could assume Shem was Pharaoh when Abraham met Pharaoh. You could assume that, you know, Shem was one of the other kings that Abraham met. Why zero in on this guy? The different name implies they're a different person unless you got a statement in the text linking them. So I consider this to be a Jewish legend that developed much, much later, and I think it's fundamentally baseless.
Thank you, Jenna. I read that cursorily, and I thought it was going to be about Shemp. But do you know anything about Shemp?
Oh, sure. Yeah. And Curly Joe.
Yeah,
and,
there we go.
You know, yeah. The other Stooges.
All right. We'll take a quick break. Thanks, Jenna. Right back with more Internet Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live. The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
This is Conversations with Consequences, where we delve deeper into issues affecting our church, our country, and our core, the family.
As Catholics, we need to be informed, aware, and able to talk through some of the tough topics that we're facing in our culture and in our world. Conversations with Consequences gives us the tools to do so.
It's not enough to pray. We have to be a light for the world.
Conversations with Consequences, Saturday at 5 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's our guest, and it's an Ask Me Anything of the internet variety. All the questions are in already from the internet. This one comes from Remy Quillmeister. If the church doesn't recognize a secular marriage as valid, why does one need an annulment if they're divorced and looking to remarry?
Well, it's not that the church doesn't recognize secular marriages as valid. In fact, in most situations, it does. Only Catholics are bound, by canon law, only Catholics are bound to observe the Catholic form of marriage or get a dispensation. So if one or both parties are Catholic, then for them, a secular marriage is going to be blocked from coming into existence under ordinary circumstances. But that's not true if neither of the parties are Catholic. If neither of the parties are Catholic, they are not bound by canon law to have a marriage, to have a Catholic marriage. So they could have a Protestant marriage, they could have a Jewish marriage, they could have a Hindu marriage, they could go down to the courthouse and have a secular marriage. And canon law will not block that marriage from coming into existence. The fancy phrase in canon law is marriage enjoys the favor of the law, which means that it's presumed to be valid until the contrary is proven. So since nothing blocks non-Catholics from having a secular marriage, if they get married, then that marriage will enjoy the favor of the law, and it will be assumed that that marriage is valid and you're bound to that person, until it's proved that the marriage was not valid. And that's why the church needs to look into such cases through the annulment process. If you had someone who was not a Catholic and they married someone who was not a Catholic in a secular service or a non-Catholic religious service, it's assumed that you are married until the contrary is proven. So if you want to marry someone else, the church needs to look into it via the annulment process.
Thank you very much for that question, Remy Quillmeister. This one comes
cool from... Cool name, by the way.
I know. It's not Bodie McBoatface, but it's good. This one comes from Jerem Sill 3. If usury is a sin, how can we move to lessen or eliminate it from our United States society?
Well, the problem is we don't currently have a rigorous definition of usury. It used to be assumed that any taking of interest was usury and thus sinful. And the reason people thought that was because at the time the economy was assumed to involve a static amount of wealth, so that wealth is neither created nor destroyed, it just gets moved around. But eventually it was realized that actually you can create new wealth. You know, like we do, for example, and this is just one example of many, but, you know, when we create new technologies, that leads to new wealth. Or when you open up a new business and your business starts creating new wealth. And so it was eventually realized that if you borrowed money, you could use that money while you had it to generate more wealth. Like you get a business loan, you start a business, you are productive, you do stuff in your business starts creating new wealth. But if you do that, then the person who loaned you the money doesn't get to do that because he doesn't have the money anymore. He gave it to you. And so you're getting a benefit out of this money. You're creating new wealth that didn't exist before. And he's getting nothing. So why shouldn't he just keep his money and use it for himself? Well, it would, if you give him an incentive, like I'll give you some interest, I'll give you not only, I'll give you back not only what you loaned me, but I'll give you a reward for giving me the use of this money for this time period, then that'll compensate you for the fact that you didn't have the use of this money for the time period you loaned it to me. And thus, you get a reward and I get a reward and we both benefit. And so usury, as a result of these insights, usury got reconceptualized as kind of basically taking too much interest. You know, the problem is we don't have a definition for what too much interest is. And it's going to vary from one circumstance to another. And therefore, Catholics are free to disagree about how much interest is too much and in what circumstances is it too much. You know, because if like something's a high risk loan as opposed to a low risk loan, well, then you're, if you're risking not getting your money back, that justifies a higher level of interest on it compared to a low risk loan where you're guaranteed to get your money back. You don't need as much of a reward because in a high risk loan, you might lose all of the money you loaned. So you need a higher reward to justify the higher risk. So Catholics are free to have different opinions about what's too much risk and in what circumstances. And they're free to advocate policies that seem wise to them based on their view of these subjects. But others who have different views are also free to advocate for other policies.
Thank you, Jerem Sill 3. Let's go to Rebecca Lynn 2046. This is a very brief question. Your takeaways from the Book of Job.
Well, my biggest takeaway is that just because an innocent person suffers doesn't mean that this person sinned and is being punished. That's the major point in the Book of Job. Also, another major point in the Book of Job is one needs to stick with... Ooh. That was an interesting sound there. Another major takeaway in the Book of Job is that one needs to stick with the true God in spite of suffering. So even when you're suffering, you need to stay faithful to God. And a third one is that if one does so, if you stick with God, even though you're suffering, the true God will eventually reward you. And that reward will be greater than what you suffered. Now, we know based on other passages, including in the New Testament, that reward may not come in this life the way it did for the character of Job. You may get that reward in heaven. But if you stick with the true God in spite of suffering, God will reward you and the reward will be bigger than what you suffered. So those are my key takeaways. There are others, but those are the ones that immediately come to the top of my mind.
And that was a very well-phrased question, Rebecca Lynn 2046. Thank you for that. This one comes from, a lot of people have numbers in their names on this source. Kaiser 4506. Kaiser asks, I just saw a clip from 7 years ago when you compared Jesus's sacrifice to that of a soldier who jumps on a grenade to protect his fellow soldiers. Thus, a similar but heavily contrived scenario would be a man who threatens to kill your family unless you end your own life. If he is an immediate threat, could it be acceptable to comply with this demand?
So in Jesus's case, in the example of throwing himself on a grenade, the comparison to a soldier throwing himself on a grenade, his death is foreseen, but he's not deliberately trying to kill himself. It's not suicide. You can foresee you're going to die, but you're not trying to kill yourself. What you're trying to do is save other people. And you may foresee I'm going to die, but if by some miracle you survive, that's great. Suicide is not your goal. Saving your buddies is your goal. And so in the same way, by being willing to go to the cross, Jesus foresaw his death, but he wasn't trying to commit suicide. He was trying to save us and just foresaw his death as a consequence of that process. The same way a soldier who jumps on a grenade foresees his death as a consequence of the process, but it's not his end, nor is it a means. It just is a side effect. So in this modified version, a standard Catholic moral appraisal would say you can't kill yourself. If someone is demanding that you put a bullet through your own brain, no, you can't do that. That's suicide. But you could let the victimizer kill you, so he takes the blame for your death. And that's closer to what happened to Jesus. You know, the Romans and the Jewish authorities killed Jesus. He didn't kill himself. And that's also similar to what was done by St. Maximilian Kolbe during World War II. He was a priest who offered his life for a man who was going to be killed by the Nazis, and he said, take me instead. He didn't kill himself, but he offered his life in the place of someone else. So if someone is saying, you need to die or your family's going to die, you could say, then kill me. But a standard moral analysis would say you can't kill yourself.
Thank you very much for that one. That was Kaiser. Thanks very much. This one comes from Captain CH6182. Does Lazarus being raised from the dead provide a counterexample to the idea that our souls become immutable after death? From what I understand, souls that are in heaven and hell are set there for eternity and cannot decide to change their mind because of their judgment being final and their soul being locked in whatever they chose their ultimate good to be after being separated from the body. So what exactly was the state of Lazarus' soul after being brought back to life? Assuming he went to the place that is called Abraham's bosom, or the limbo of the fathers, he was already prepared for heaven. In fact, Lazarus is now a saint. So does that mean he remained completely sinless throughout the remainder of his life, or was he still able to fall into sin and never repent and instead be judged into hell?
Okay, so at regular death, our wills become fixed on either good or evil. It's not entirely clear that Lazarus experienced regular death, though, since it was a temporary death. So you could say, well, maybe his will didn't become fixed. On the other hand, I think it's probable that it was fixed on good while he was dead. But he then returned to a normal mortal state of existence. And while undoubtedly he had some after effects from heaven, I think that the state he returned to, and this isn't provable, but I think it's very likely that the state he returned to included the full range of free will options that are normally open to us in this life. And that's consistent with what we see with near-death experiencers. Near-death experiencers commonly come back with a more spiritual, loving attitude towards others, but they're not completely sinless. And so I think the same thing was likely true of Lazarus. His will may have been fixed on good while he was dead, but once he came back to a pre-glorified earthly existence, his will would have reverted to a pre-glorified state that had the option of choosing, but he likely had a more spiritual, loving outlook as a result of his experiences in the afterlife, the same way near-death experiencers tend to.
The second part of his question is, this is a hypothetical scenario. Let's say that Lazarus was married. Now, if the marriage bond ends at the death of one of the spouses, what does that mean when Lazarus comes back to life? What would be the state of their relationship? What would he and the woman who was his wife have to go through, or would they have to go through the whole process of marrying again if they wanted to continue their relationship? If so, would that mean it is technically possible to marry the same person twice? Also, if Lazarus and his wife didn't know about marriage ending at death, would they be committing adultery were they to engage in relations?
So the church didn't have a teaching on this, but it appears that the marriage commitment that people make to each other is for this life. And if someone is restored to this life, then the marriage commitment revives. I mean, I they committed until I leave this life permanently, I'm with you. So if there's just a little temporary interruption, I'm still with you. So it wouldn't be adultery for Lazarus and Mrs. Lazarus to have marital relations. They wouldn't need to get married again. And this is also typically what happens with near-death experiencers. They come back and they regard them and their wife as still married. So it seems that the marriage bond's only permanently severed when you leave this life permanently, though you will come back to an upgraded resurrection one day.
You made me read a lot there, Captain CH6182, but we got it all in. Thank you for the question. Thanks to everybody who sent their questions in. And thank you to you, Jimmy Akin. I appreciate those 2 hours.
My pleasure.
That'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.